It's 6 after 9. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. When it comes to climate change, we may be asking the wrong questions. There are ethical issues connected to climate change that need to be addressed even before all of the scientific uncertainties are settled. That's what my guest this hour says. He is Donald A. Brown, Associate Professor of Environmental Ethics, Science, and Law, and is the director of the Collaborative Program on Ethical Dimensions of Climate Change at the Rock Ethics Institute at Penn State University. Professor Brown, good morning, and thanks for taking time to be on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
You argue that for over 30 years, the public climate change debate is focused on the wrong scientific questions compared to those that ethics would ask of climate science. What do you mean by that?
Sure. Ethics would make those that are on notice that they are doing something extraordinarily dangerous, they would be required to cease that behavior once they have reasonable notice that, in fact, what they are doing is dangerous. The United States Academy of Sciences in 1979, for the first time and many times since then, has continued to alert the American people that climate change is a huge, huge threat. Most of the science of climate change, and a lot of people are unaware of this, has never been in question. The basic physics, how the natural greenhouse gas effect works. To make a very, very long story shorter, there's been a series of reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that every 5 years that have continued to increase confidence, reaching virtual certainty on a number of issues that climate change, human induced rather than natural variability in climate change, is a huge threat. Ethics would ask scientists not do we know for sure, but is there a strong enough threshold level of science to know that what we're doing is creating plausible dangerous impacts. I argue that we knew that well over 30 years ago, and that once we're on notice of that, we need to see it as an ethical and moral problem, not simply as a scientific problem. And once we see it as an ethical problem, we have to see that what we do as uncertainties are being resolved, we have to consider not only our interests, but the interests of tens of millions of people around the world who are harmed by climate change. So ethics would have us take into consideration not simply our interests, but the duties, responsibilities, and obligations that we have to small island developing states, to millions of people in Africa, Southeast Asia. So we must see uncertainty, scientific uncertainty, as a moral and ethical question, and that has broad implications, not only for our duties, but how we talk about scientific skeptics, how we talk about science, and a whole variety of other issues.
Yeah, you use a couple of terms that I'd like to have you give some examples of what you mean by them, which that was a horribly constructed sentence, but we'll move on. You talk about the scientifically known rather than the scientifically plausible. Can you give me an example of each of those two things?
Sure. Well, since 1850, we've known very, very precisely if we add a greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, such as carbon dioxide or methane, what the initial heating potential will be to the planet. It's called forcing, climate forcing. So we've known for 150 years exactly how much warming we would expect if we add additional molecules. There is a whole long list of things that we have known for sure about climate change. But we still don't know exactly quantitatively what the temperature will be given this increased warming. or more importantly, where the harshest impacts will be experienced, and what the timing of those harsh impacts will be. So climate science consists of a huge amount of scientific information that has never seriously been in question. And it's also a growing amount of science is starting to pin down exactly where the impacts will be and what the magnitude of those impacts will be. Yet, there is a strong possibility that we may have rapid, non-linear temperature impacts, which will be extraordinarily catastrophic if they happen. So that is in the unknown category.
What do you mean by non-linear temperature?
Well, we know the Earth has historically been much, much different than it has been for the last 10,000 years. We happen to be living in a period where both the greenhouse gases and the temperatures for the last 10,000 years have been relatively stable. But if you look at the Earth's temperature changes going back into history, there have been rapid changes, 5 or 6 degrees centigrade in a period of decades. There are tipping points in the climate system that we know that they were there, but we don't know exactly where they are. But there is growing evidence that we are approaching tipping points. Then, rather than smooth climate change, we will get we may get rapid increases in temperature at a speed that neither humans or plants and animals will be able to adapt to. So we know that this has happened in the past and is likely to happen in the future. To give you a concrete example, what has most scientists around the world most worried is sea level rise. Both Greenland and the West Antarctic ice sheet are showing some early signs of rapid deterioration because the ice that's actually holding up the ice sheets is starting to disintegrate, and there is certainly a possibility that instead of a couple of centimeters, a couple of inches per decade, we would start to see 3 and 4 feet of sea level, in rise in the century, and even faster levels. So, the climate system has been in the past and is likely to be highly unstable, and we are conducting an experiment right now that very well may trigger rapid changes. If that weren't bad enough, even if the climate changes rises more smoothly, there are huge threats for some people in the world, particularly countries like Bangladesh, millions of people in Africa, and small island developing states. So even if it changes smoothly, and temperatures and impacts are experienced at what that we call the upper bounds of things that are likely to happen, we are putting millions of people around the world and the ecological systems on which they depend at great risk.
Let me ask you this, and I have a hunch I know what the answer is already, but that's okay. Why haven't we done anything,
well,
given what
really,
we know?
That's a really, really good question. We have been debating this issue for 30 years, and those opposing climate change have made two kinds of arguments. One, they've made arguments about we don't know for sure what's going to happen, the scientific uncertainty argument. And probably even more commonly, they argue that the costs are too great. It will, if we take action, it will reduce in the case of the United States, gross domestic product. It will hurt hurt coal jobs in Pennsylvania. And so opposition to climate change has been largely organized by fossil fuel interests who have been continuing and successfully making claims that if we take action on climate change, we will hurt our economy. Now, most economists don't agree with this, a lot can be said about these economic and scientific claims, but it's quite clear opposition that has been successful is attributable to a lot of people who are very, very well organized through not only lobbyists, but at least 50 or 60 think tanks that are funded by corporate and fossil fuel interests have, in some cases, been spreading what we now know is complete disinformation about the significance of taking action. There have been reasonable climate skeptics, not all of the skeptics that have raised questions about the science of climate change. I would put into the category of people that I'm talking about now, but there has been a huge, huge, well-funded, well-organized disinformation campaign. There's three or four books just this year that have been released that trace how this has all worked, where the money has come from. And these organizations, every time someone proposes a policy or a law on climate change, they send reports to the media and to the legislators and have been working quite successfully to send out a huge amount of disinformation, both about what we know about climate change and what the economic impacts are.
Okay. Well, I want to invite our listeners to get involved in this discussion because I have a hunch we'll get a lot of calls today. This is always a hot issue, and I already have an email in front of me that I'll share in just a moment. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's the toll-free number to call to be involved in the program this morning. We're talking about the ethics of climate change. It's related to the science of climate change, but it asks different questions than we have asked so far. And we're exploring what those questions should be. What should we be talking about? What should the discussion center on, rather than, you know, is this real or not real? It's more about what is our obligation as citizens of the earth to do something about this, given what we know and what seems most plausible. That's kind of the center of the discussion. My guest is Donald A. Brown, Associate Professor of Environmental Ethics, Science, and Law, and the Director of the Collaborative Program on Ethical Dimensions of Climate Change at the Rock Ethics Institute of Penn State University. You can join us by phone. You can send an email to talk@wpr.org, or you can go to Facebook and look for the Kathleen Dunn fan page and leave a post there, and we will share it with the listening audience. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. 9:21, you're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Coming up later on the Ideas Network, after 3 on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, from the Best of the Inside Islam series, Jean Faraca and her guests discuss Islamic feminism and how it's developed from within Islam. That's after 3 o'clock this afternoon, Here on Earth with Jean Faraca. This hour, we're talking about the ethics of climate change and the kinds of questions we should be asking compared to the questions that we have been asking. And as I mentioned earlier, my guest is Donald A. Brown, Associate Professor of Environmental Ethics, Science, and Law at Penn State University. He joins me by phone. We've got others waiting to join. First, though, I want to share an email from Steve in Oshkosh. Professor Brown, he has a question for you. And here's what Steve has to say. It seems to me that China's argument for a carbon budget based on national historical responsibility for cumulative per capita emissions is a strong argument. However, it seems to me that a carbon trading mechanism should give priority to countries with the lowest emissions so that the least developed nations benefit first and foremost. What do you think of that?
Well, that is a really good question. We like to say that climate change raises not just one civilization-challenging ethical question, but dozens of them. And one of the questions, the ethical questions, that climate change raises is how do we fairly allocate responsibility to nations given differences in historical emissions, current emissions levels, the need of the really poor countries to get themselves out of poverty. We like to say in climate change ethics, if you frame something as an ethical question, it will not necessarily result in absolute agreement among ethicists as to what ethics requires, although sometimes it does. In the case of climate change, we believe many of the ethical questions, there is what we call an overlapping consensus between ethical theories about what is required. But one area where there is a difference is among ethical theories about how do you treat China differently and the United States differently is one of those areas where different ethical systems would actually reach different ethical conclusions. However, having said that, spotting the ethical questions about how you allocate responsibilities does allow almost everyone to say that specific proposals, including the proposals made by the United States, in some cases Canada and Australia, no ethical system would condone. So the U.S. has been taking the position on this issue on what our responsibility is vis-a-vis China, that we believe that no ethical system would condone. The leading theories for how do you make differences from China would take into account historical emissions and differences in per capita emissions between China and the United States, as well as other large emitters. This is a really complicated area. Time will allow me to get into some of the details of what an ethical analysis of these issues would consist of. But let me say, the U.S. has been now for 30 years, actually since 1990 in the international negotiations, been taking the position that the United States would not do anything until China did something. Another claim that you will frequently hear is that China is the largest polluter so that we don't have to do anything. We believe the analysis of those claims would reveal that those claims aren't entitled to any ethical respect. All countries immediately, including China, should have 20 years ago reduced their emissions to their fair share of safe global emissions, regardless of what other countries did. We have been using for 20 years the excuse, we don't have to do anything until China does something. We believe that very strong ethical arguments can be made that that position is ethically bankrupt. Our duty, as well as all high-emitting countries, is to immediately reduce our emissions to our fair share of safe global emissions, and we can't use as an excuse, we can't do this because China hasn't done yet. That would result in absurd results that no polluter would have to emit to all other polluters emitted, and we believe no ethical system would condone that position.
Let's go to the phones and take a call from Bill in Mellon first. Bill, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning to you. I'd like to raise two ethical questions. Number one, what is the ethics concerning that scandal in the British University that seems to be the center of this global warming theory? I think they were caught fudging data to match their analysis or their theory. And my second question is what about the ethics of creating some massive new regimen of carbon taxes to be assessed against the American economy at a point right now where economic misery is as high in this country as I can ever remember in my lifetime. We've got a recession now that's over twice as long as the one that Ronald Reagan inherited when he entered office, and we've had a stimulus policy that hasn't seemed to stimulate anything. Do we need a huge new burden of taxes on top of this?
Bill, thanks for the questions. Professor?
Yes, two good questions. A lot of people have been confused greatly by something called the Emailgate scandal, in which several thousand emails were taken from University of East Anglia. For about 2 or 3 months, the press's reporting is that this proved that the climate change was a hoax, even though all along, if the claims were true, about the Emailgate scandal, they didn't go at all to the main evidence that has allowed the scientific community to attribute human causation to climate change. But most importantly for the scandal, this episode has now been thoroughly reviewed by the American Meteorological Society, the American Geophysical Union, and a host of other people have reviewed what is called the Emailgate scandal and completely exonerated the participants in this, while reaffirming that none of this has ever seriously dented the basic conclusions of mainstream science. So most people see quite clearly this is far behind us. It was a tempest in a teapot. Doesn't dent the mainstream view. This year looks like it's going to be the warmest year in history. We're shattering record temperatures around the world. So the second question about whether in an economic downturn we should be adopting climate change legislation. And here, again, if you see this as an ethical question, you reach wildly different conclusions than if you simply see it as a matter of self-interest. If this were a matter of self-interest alone, we could consider our economic situation alone and not consider the interests of the small island developing states and all the people I've been talking about before. Ethics would have us reduce our emissions because we're reaching potentially catastrophic levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and we have a duty to not only to think about our own economic interests, but the interests of people around the world. Even if it costs us money, we must begin to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And there's always been a lot that we could do that would not only not cost us a lot of money, but would actually save us money. About 40% of the energy that we've wasted, we use, is completely wasted. There are huge reductions in greenhouse gas emissions that we now know, A, will create jobs, but B, in many cases, will save money. So at the very, very minimum, we should be aggressively taking steps that would not create economic chaos. As you know, there are a lot of economists believe that the future to turning the economy around is also to invest in these new technologies. So even a strong case can be made. It's in our economic interest to start to tackle this problem.
You mentioned the CO2 levels and so forth. According to a statistic that I saw, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced, I think it was by the end of May, that we had reached an all-time high for the last 2.1 million years in carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. That ought to be of some concern to someone.
It really should be a huge concern to everybody. We're at, I think, 393 parts per million of carbon dioxide, which we know with high levels of confidence is higher than the last, I think, 2.1 million years. And we're headed up.
Well, Bill, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Scott in Green Bay. Scott, good morning.
Good morning. I think the ethics of, I don't want to say climate change, but just the ethics in general of taking care of the planet and not polluting and doing the right thing is a great conversation to have. I think where we get twisted a little bit is the gloom and doom and the world is going to end. I mean, it seems like there are too often in history, a perfect example of that is the population boom. Oh, we were all going to run out of food, minimal resources, and there's too many people on Earth, and we're realizing that just isn't occurring. I mean, that was a huge concern probably about 40 or 50 years ago. It seems like there, my opinion always has been when people come up with the concept of the consensus of scientists say X. There is no science when you have consensus, because science is not about consensus. There are some very brilliant, and not in the pockets of big oil, that's kind of what people say, brilliant scientists who have an issue who, and there are hundreds of them, I have lists of them, who disagree with the concept of us causing global warming. We don't get to have the conversation anymore because one side, the ones who really are firmly invested in this, call the other side names. You know, where's the ethics in that? We're deniers. We're kind of equated to the Holocaust deniers. We don't get to have this great conversation anymore because it seems like it's an agenda-driven topic. And that's what bothers me more than anything else, is the lack of having good dialogue and conversation without the people that believe in climate change really ridiculing and calling people names. Because there are some great scientists out there, hundreds of them, that have a different version of what's going on.
Professor?
Sure. I think that's a fair observation for someone sort of watching this debate, this 30-year debate. I would argue, though, that the science of this obviously should proceed from descriptions of what we know and what we don't know. And as I've said before, there's a lot that we know. The science has always been a range of upper and lower bounds. If you increase greenhouse gases to this level, what is the minimum and maximum temperature? So the way the mainstream scientific community talks about this is in terms of a range of possible impacts. That range has been developed by what's called the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, and now every scientific organization in the world, including, I've got a list of about 30 of them, these are scientific organizations such as the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Chemical Society, the American Astronomical Society. I won't read through the list, but what people don't know is that the real scientists that publish in peer-reviewed literature have all said that they support a statement. Now, the statement that they support, the nuances of that statement must be understood for what it says. It says that we now know with high levels of confidence, A, that the planet is warming, and B, it's attributable to human causes. That doesn't say we know exactly what's going to happen. What that is, we know that it's not natural variability and that the planet is warming, and the planet is warming in direct proportion to the release of fossil fuels around the world. There are a lot of people denying this, but they don't know the evidence, in my experience. They don't know the evidence, for instance, is how in the world could you know that the temperatures are being caused not by natural variability, but by human causation? And here there's a host of scientific analyses that have looked very, very closely at that. If the sun is causing the problem, for instance, the upper atmosphere heats up at the same rate that the lower atmosphere. If it's being trapped by greenhouse gases, the lower atmosphere gets warmer and the upper atmosphere gets colder. Lo and behold, you look at what's happening and it points directly to greenhouse gases, not natural variability. If humans are causing the problem, then the amount of radiation that is escaping into outer space decreases as heating increases. These are all what are called attribution studies and fingerprint studies, and they all point to human causation. If humans are causing climate change, then the chemical isotope signature of the carbon we're finding in the atmosphere is different than if it's natural variability. It is virtually undeniable, according to the mainstream scientific position, that this is human causation, not natural variability. And I could go on. So, yes, we need to have a reasoned public debate about this. And in some cases, I would agree with the caller that charges are made. But eventually, we've got to get to what the evidence says and rely upon scientific organizations that have expertise, all of which have now supported the position of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
So would you characterize this as, for example, you may not believe in gravity, but gravity believes in you?
I think that's a pretty good summary. I mean, that most people following the debate, not deeply, but don't understand the magnitude of the evidence that attribute what we're seeing to human causation. And ethics, by the way, would say once you're on notice that you may be causing great harm to other people, you have a duty to act, okay? And that only asking what we know for sure is the wrong question. Most civilizations make dangerous behavior not only wrong but criminal. I've been in the negotiation. I was a former negotiator at the United Nations, and I know that countries around the world that are vulnerable, they see this, and with good reason, as a death sentence to them. They are amazed that some of the larger polluting countries have been unwilling to do anything for 30 years because we're passing the point which we can protect them. And so we have obligations to other people. We can't think of this problem as simply a matter of U.S. interest. And that's why turning up the volume on the ethical and moral dimensions of this problem is so important.
We are talking about the ethics of climate change this hour. And by the way, Scott, thanks for the call. And you may want to stick around and listen to the next hour, because I'm going to have a couple of experts on who say that food and population really are problems, and we're about to run into a wall there as well. So it's, the 2 hours this morning are related. That sometimes that happens. We're talking, though, about the ethics of climate change this hour with Donald Brown, who's Associate Professor of Environmental Ethics, Science, and Law at Penn State University. And wondering what you think. Full phones right now, but you can also send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or leave a post on our Facebook page. Look for Kathleen Dunn, the Kathleen Dunn fan page, and you can leave a post there. We'll share it with the audience. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 9:41. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Next hour, we'll be talking about food production in the world today by looking at current agricultural technology, population, climate change, and the global economy. We'll be talking about the book Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Should be an interesting hour. This hour, we're talking about the ethics of climate change. My guest is Donald A. Brown, Associate Professor of Environmental Ethics, Science, and Law, and the director of the Collaborative Program on Ethical Dimensions of Climate Change at the Rock Ethics Institute at Penn State University. We have full phone lines, so let's go to the phones, and we'll talk to Gary in Merrill first. Gary, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Well, I come from the view that I think we should have a national oil holiday for all the fantastic things that brings us. I can stand alongside my car for 30 seconds and put enough energy in it to travel 600 miles. We hardly hear about smog anymore in the bigger cities. We clean the coal out of the plants. The cars have gotten extremely better gas mileage and what comes out of the exhaust. I think we should be patting ourselves on the back on all the advances we've made. I can't see anything coming to take the place of coal and oil. So the other thing, as far as ethics, and your next show, I guess we'll talk about it. I think there's places in the world where they're having the population having too many kids, and I think the moral part of it should be we have to help areas in the world reduce their population. Otherwise, I think within another 50 years, we're going to double the population of the world, and regardless of oil or whatever, we just can't feed that number of people. So, thank you.
Thanks, Gary. Professor?
Sure. I take it part of the comments were about that there are no easy solutions to this problem, even though we in the past have made rapid technological advances to solve other environmental problems. Most people looking at this problem realize that there's no easy solution, and therefore we have to do lots of many different things, but starting with conservation and moving to more fuel-efficient automobiles, etc. So one thing about climate change that people do not know, usually in my experience, is the amount of global reductions that we need to prevent really, really dangerous climate change. The world is emitting about 7 billion tons of carbon per year, and we're headed to 20. And the mainstream scientific view says to prevent really dangerous climate change, we've got to reduce the 7 to 2 gigatons of carbon in the next 30 or 50 years. So the rate of reduction that we need to prevent climate change, according to the mainstream scientific view, is huge. But there are solutions, and many parts of the world are getting ahead of the United States already without putting their populations back in the cave era. Northern Europe, China now has more solar and wind than the United States. Many European countries are way ahead of us in terms of renewable energy. And so there are a lot of things we could be doing that we're not doing. The U.S. is really falling behind some of the rest of the world.
Well, and according to a report that I saw yesterday, the European economy is booming while ours is still in the doldrums. So maybe they do know something we don't. Thanks for the call, Gary. Let's go next to Madison, and we'll talk with Bill. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. These last few callers really make me upset. Anyway, what I think that the guest is right about the ethical questions, but I think he's wrong that they haven't been considered. I think they've been considered already, and the conclusions have been made that since the human race is a top it's an apex predator. It's the first time in the world history where you have 7 billion of an apex predator sitting on top. Basically, the food pyramid is upside down. And we've already decided that the needs of humans are more important than the needs of all the other creatures that live on Earth. And we've already decided that the needs of Americans are more important than the needs of human beings living elsewhere. And most specifically, we've already decided that the needs of the people living today are more important than the needs of the people who are going to be coming after us. I personally have no optimism that this problem is going to get solved by anything short of the near extinction of the human race. I mean, if the human population got reduced magically somehow to 1 billion instead of 7 billion, we could the planet could probably carry that just fine, and with everybody driving their SUVs and living the good life. But as it is right now, it's just not going to happen. And I think that most people have already decided that the sacrifices and the expenditures needed to really address the problem are something that other people elsewhere are going to do, not us. I'll take reaction off the air.
Thanks, Bill. So, Professor, we've made our choice. We considered it. We made our choice, and it may have been the wrong one, but we've made it.
Yeah, the question is I think one that is widely held by a lot of people. It is not my view or experience that we have made our choice, or that we've framed the issue as an ethical and moral question. I have my students track the arguments being made against climate change, and all of the arguments are such as, well, we can't do this because it will hurt the coal industry in Pennsylvania or West Virginia. They're short-term economic arguments, or they're scientific arguments. No one is making the argument, no politician is making the argument, well, yeah, we have to think about economic impacts, but we have duties and responsibilities to Africa. The ethical dimension of this issue is not being framed, in my experience. I gave a speech to the Scottish Parliament to give you an example of another way that this could be discussed publicly. And much to my surprise, the Scottish parliamentarians were pounding on the desk. One of them was, and five others were saying to the Scottish people, we must reduce our emissions, not even though it may cost us something, because we owe it to the rest of the world. We have obligations. In Scotland, I saw an example of politicians making the ethical argument. I have been following this issue for 30 years, and I've never seen one politician make the argument that the Scottish parliamentarian would make. And by the way, we need a cultural change that will create rapid changes. That cultural change is possible, in my view. It is a long story, but I believe by framing it as a moral issue is a strategy to get the cultural change that we need, which will lead to very rapid changes in behavior.
I don't want to put words in Bill's mouth, but I guess what I took away from that is that each of us, as individuals, not collectively as governments or you know, civilizations, but each of us as individuals has made a choice. You know, we're at the top of the food chain, and we're going to do whatever we want, and I'm going to keep driving my car burning this or burning that or what, you know, I've made a choice, and this is how I'm going to do it, and the chips will fall where they may. Bill, if you're still with us, does that come close to what you were actually talking about? Do we still have Bill? I think we lost him. I'm sorry. Well, but, you know, that's kind of what I got out of that. Each of us individually has already made a choice.
Sure. I think some subset of the population, once they understood the science better and saw it as an ethical issue, would make other choices. We didn't get civil rights until we saw the dogs on the bridge in Selma, Alabama, and all of a sudden there was a rapid cultural change in the United States. Recycling is something that we saw rapid cultural changes because it became cool to recycle and really uncool to not recycle. So it does seem to me that there is hope, if you believe that the science is real, we should all be thinking about how do we make a cultural change so everybody is getting away from the wrong use of energy while moving into more sustainable energy. All throughout Europe, the way people are talking about it, the way they're behaving is completely different than in the United States, and they're doing it at no significant social cost. In fact, I believe that the things they're doing actually help other problems and support communities, but we have not had the cultural shift here in the United States that is actually taking place in other parts of the world.
We have an email from Liz in New Berlin who says what she finds so infuriating in the mainstream coverage of climate change is the issue of balance as bias. News outlets profess to be unbiased by bringing in scientists who believe that climate change is occurring, followed by scientists who don't believe it is. This places the idea in the mind of the public that the two stances are equal when there is much more evidence that climate change is occurring than to the contrary. There is seemingly unending, unnecessary debate that is getting in the way of progress. I think you would agree with that.
Oh, I completely agree with that, and there's a lot of studies about how the media has covered this, and they all would confirm the insights of that comment. It is not true that that there is an even divide between reasonable skeptics and researchers. One report just came out last week. 98% of the scientists that do research in this field, that actually do research, believe in what is called the consensus view, as I articulate what that view is before. But that's not how the media has been covering this issue. Yes.
We have a lot of callers waiting to join us, and we only have about 5 or 6 minutes of the program left. So I want to get through as many of these calls as we can. We'll start with Gary in Fitchburg. Gary, good morning.
Perhaps the answers could be a little bit more concise, and the host could allow more callers through. Here's my question. I've been waiting for 20 minutes. First of all, the email controversy that took place right before Copenhagen was designed to derail much of the planning that went on for Copenhagen. So that was very unfortunate. But, you know, I see it as a conspiracy to derail a lot of planning that went on for the Copenhagen climate change conference that was, you know, a lot of people put a lot of work into that. Regarding the current Obama cap-and-trade plan, that, in my opinion, is another scam. It allows polluters to keep on polluting, but yet they can buy, you know, buy pollution from somebody else that supposedly, even if their company shuts down and quits operating, some other polluter can buy those pollution credits and keep on spewing junk out of their factories or into the streams or whatever. So we need leadership. We're not getting it from Obama. Obama was a Trojan horse put in there by the elite. And, you know, he's going to ruin the Democratic Party by design. But thanks.
Thanks for the call, Gary. Professor?
Yeah, I agree that the email scandal was a attempt to derail Copenhagen. That's pretty well documented exactly how it worked. And I also agree that we need another kind of leadership on this issue, one that talks about our obligations to the rest of the world.
Let's go next to Paul in Duluth. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. Boy, I was going to go a little bit at length, but let me keep. I'll keep it brief. The American people that still believe in corporate ethics should realize that it's become an oxymoron. Several years ago, there was a kerfuffle about opening the Northwest Passage that depended on an ice-free Arctic for at least a big part of the year. And not only Russia, but the United States and Canada are already planning on that. So what we have is nations and corporations going for short-term gain by opening a sea lane between Western Europe and East Asia, and they have a vested interest in global climate change. And I take your comments off the air, please.
And we only have about a minute.
Yeah, there is a lot of new information of how corporations with vested interest have organized opposition to climate change. There are 4 new books just this year. They're quite credible. And so there is clear evidence that corporations with, not all corporations, of course, in the fossil fuel industry, but many coal interests, petroleum interests, have been funding a disinformation campaign which has been successful in confusing the American people about what this is about.
So what do we do? I mean, we've come to the end of the program, unfortunately. Right. We haven't asked this question yet. This happens to me a lot. What do we do?
Well, I believe we need to encourage people to see the moral dimensions of this issue. We need to talk about not only about our interests, which are relevant, but our duties and responsibilities and obligations to the rest of the world. We need to get to a place where we have a politician in the United States talking like the Scottish parliamentarian did, and that is a strategy to make the cultural shift that we need. My website, climateethics.org, we go through, anybody interested in this issue can get much more deeper into the dozens and dozens of civilization ethical questions created by climate change.
Climateethics.org. Thank you very much, Professor Brown, for an interesting hour.
Thank you.
Donald A. Brown, Associate Professor of Environmental Ethics, Science, and Law, and the Director of the Collaborative Program on Ethical Dimensions of Climate Change at the Rock Ethics Institute at Penn State University. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. Rhonda Fanning and Dave Potras handled on-air production this morning. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. Stick around, another hour coming up next.